Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Talk to those who work with children in New Hampshire, and they'll tell you the opioid epidemic is affecting kids. If a parent is addicted, children might be ignored, hungry, or abused. And these struggles at home will often lead to struggles in school, trouble with peers, and mental health problems. Last week, NHPR's Morning Edition team examined these issues and more in a series called Taking a Toll. It's part of NHPR's broader Crossroads series covering the impacts of addiction in New Hampshire. And today in The Exchange, we pick up on that work, and let's get you into our conversation. Your questions and comments, of course, are welcome. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have several guests in studio, but we're going to begin with Mary McIntyre, Morning Edition producer who worked on the series. And Mary, it's great to see you in the studio. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
So why did you and Rick Ganley, Mary, decide that this topic needed a week, needed more time for deeper examination?
Sure. So we'd been talking about this topic in the newsroom for quite a while now, and the more we talked to people out in the field, the more we realized that this really needed to be a five-part series. There was just so much to cover.
So much there, and it wasn't enough to just do it in an occasional story. Right,
right, yeah. Exactly.
So what did you learn, Mary, after talking to all these people and spending a week digging into this?
Right. Well, there are a lot of people in New Hampshire who are concerned with how the opioid epidemic is affecting children. But what we kept hearing over and over was that there's this gap in services. So for both children who have a family member, like a parent or a guardian who is struggling with opioid use, or even for teens themselves who might be struggling as well, there's already a lack of services for the number of adults in New Hampshire who are struggling with substance use, let alone children who are struggling themselves with these same issues. Yeah.
So gaps in services. Mm-hmm. What especially surprised you, Mary? Some aspect of the story that going into it you had not thought about before?
Sure. So substance use is something that infiltrates every part of a child's life, really. So I think we're just surprised to see how many people who you wouldn't be expecting to step up and help out. You know, for example, we spoke with the outreach coordinator for the Nashua Public Library. They've been partnering with the city and nonprofits to provide services for children and adults. That includes hosting visitations between parents and children who might be separated at
really,
the time.
Really, at the library?
Yeah, at the library. It's something that's in the public. It's visible. It's accessible for people who are in Nashua. So things like that, just people who you wouldn't expect to be really out there helping out.
Well, and it's a sad topic, obviously, but one of the things I found uplifting about it, Mary, was people like the ones that you talked to who are doing what they can to help. And since you mentioned the librarian, Carol
Iman.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear a little bit from her. She said the opioid epidemic has definitely affected her workplace.
We do have full-time security. They get to really know the regulars that come in that might have problems, and they know about how to refer them to services. They have training in Narcan, the use of Narcan, and we have some of our other staff members have been trained in that too, or at least trained to recognize overdose symptoms, which is, sometimes you hear librarians say, this is not what I went to library school to learn, but it's part of being open to the public and being available to anybody.
Other people you talk to, Mary, especially when we talk about kids who struggle, schools, principals,
yes,
guidance counselors, what did you hear from people working in the schools?
Sure. So we also talked to Tim Lena. He's with the Timber Lane Regional School District, and he coordinated student assistance programs there. So those programs can help connect students to services or providers out in the community, and they can also provide a safe space for students to talk with one another who are struggling with the same issues at home. And again, just because this topic infiltrates every part of a child's life, it's really important you have teachers and school administrators who, you know, are really having to fill in that piece for kids.
Sure. They notice somebody's struggling in class and can't focus or is, you know, falling asleep because there was disruption at that home last night.
Right, exactly.
I found that interview, actually, Mary, with Tim Lena very moving. He talked about just the whole psychology of what he sees with these children. And as you said, he said he's tried to work very hard to create a safe place because these kids are, in his words, very guarded. Let's hear.
There are three rules that they learn to survive. Don't talk, don't trust, and don't feel. So the first thing is, you know, you learn to be somewhat ashamed and somewhat embarrassed about what's happening in the family. You tend to be very closed off. You don't even share that necessarily with your close friends. And the family gives that message that you don't talk about family business outside of a family. So they learn from a very young age to kind of keep that close to the chest.
Again, that's Tim Lena. He coordinates school assistance programs for the Timberlane Regional District. Last question for you, Mary. What are the stories that you wanted to tell in this series, but you just couldn't find time or you didn't have the right person? What was sort of, as we used to say, left on the cutting room floor?
Sure. Well, of course, we would have liked to talk to a young person who is dealing with this themselves. But, you know, as Tim Lena had just said, sometimes, you know, kids, they don't want to talk about these kinds of things often. So, you know, that was something that I think we would have liked to have, but again, it just takes time for kids to want to open up about these sort of things. And, you know, there's also the worry if you have a family member, a parent who's struggling with this, you know, the ramifications, of course. But outside of that, I think there's definitely several stories to follow up on that our newsroom will be working on. It'll be interesting to see how DCYF continues to work on its response to the opioid epidemic, especially with kids. We didn't end up featuring any first responders in this series, but they're on the front lines every day experiencing how this affects children. So there's still a lot to cover there.
Okay. Enough to keep you plenty busy. Mary, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Mary McIntyre, Morning Edition producer, who produced the recent Taking a Toll series on the impact of the opioid epidemic on New Hampshire's children. And today in the Exchange, we're following up on the issues raised in this series with Granite Staters deeply involved in this issue. Let's hear from you, too. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. What effects of the opioid crisis have you seen on kids you know? And what do you think the best way is to help these children? Again, you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Moira O'Neill. She's director of the New Hampshire Office of the Child Advocate. And Moira, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Rebecca Whitley. She's policy director for the New Hampshire Children's Behavioral Health Collaborative. And Rebecca, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Peter Evers, CEO of Riverbend Community Mental Health, which provides a variety of services for children and families across the state. And Peter, welcome back. Good to see you.
You too, Lauren.
Well, all of you, I want to start broadly and then get into some of the specifics. But Peter, to you first, in this series, you said that children are at the sharp end of the addiction issue in this country. What did you mean by that?
Well, first of all, I just want to thank NHPR for taking on this issue. Oftentimes we hear a lot of sound bites about substance use disorder and we hear language that is absolutely not appropriate. I was watching the Emmys the other night and the two hosts used the word crackhead. And I thought, you know, we have a long way to go on using language that is appropriate for a disease that many people struggle with. So I really appreciate the time that you spent going into this. Children are a vulnerable population. We know that right from the get-go. The services that are available for children provide, in some ways, a way of keeping them safe. But I think the main point that I want to make is that when somebody is struggling with a disease of addiction, you have to think about what their primary relationship is. And their primary relationship is not, at that point, any longer with their child. Their primary relationship is getting a substance which is going to make them feel better because they're in the throes of addiction. And when you begin to think about it like that, you think, wow, that is a tremendous vulnerability for small children. But it's also a vulnerability for latency age kids and adolescents, just in terms of every stage of child development. If that parental connection is missing or is dysregulated by something like another primary relationship, those children are going to be in trouble. And I think it's true that those kids are encouraged not to talk about that. There's already a stigma that exists in schools and in society about families who struggle with addiction. So not being a messenger is a real problem because they really are told that they can't speak about this.
Well, and kids don't want to be different from the other kids. They want to have the quote-unquote normal family like everyone else.
That's right. And if you think about the way that addiction is portrayed in media, in social media, those are all references back to this is shameful, this is something I can't talk about. So even though the psychic pain that these kids are struggling with, it is even worse they feel if they go out and speak about it.
What do we know, Moira, about what happens to the child's brain, the child's psychological health, when that connection is disrupted? I'm so struck by what Peter says, that when a parent is, you know, heavily addicted, it's heroin first, child second. What does that do to a child's emotional and mental development?
Thanks for that question. It's really so important to think about child development in general in these kinds of epidemics. And I want to reiterate that point that Peter just made about the primary relationship. I mean, oftentimes when you speak to people about addictions, they talk about an emotional regression. So people actually become less mature in their emotional relationships with people. They become very self-centered. And so the whole concept of parenting is sort of lost on them. You know, you actually lose your capacity to be able to pay attention to the needs of somebody else, certainly a small child. And then on the other side of it, the child's brain that's developing very early on, what the most important sort of accomplishments of a child that's growing up is to have attachments to people, is to be able to trust. And we think about babies, you know, crying, we feed them. When they cry, they learn that if they communicate with us at a very primitive level, that we will feed them, we will keep them warm, we will clothe them.
The world is a
right,
safe place.
Sure. But so when that response doesn't happen, the baby keeps crying and gets no response. And then you start to learn these other sort of not such useful and appropriate behaviors because your parents aren't responding to your needs. And so then you're going to see this really wonderful science on the brain development now that shows us that all the way through that person's life, you know, all the way to adulthood, they may become addicted themselves. They may be depressed. They may have heart disease. They may have difficulty in schools. They may not be able to keep a job. I mean, it really is showing us that if we don't meet a child's needs at the very beginning, we've created a problem throughout that lifespan.
There's so much research now
yeah.
on the impacts of trauma, early trauma, on the childhood, on the child brain. And you're giving us kind of a scary picture, Moira, of what happens to that child, you know, down the line.
It is. There really is an arc of problem throughout. Now, of course, on the other side of it, there's also resiliency. So, you know, if a child has these extreme adverse childhood experiences, but there's a safety net around them, there are people who care about them, the child knows that they're loved and their needs are met, then there's a good chance that child will recover from that. But that's why we have a child welfare system, and that's why the child welfare system right now is so under stress, because they've got to be able to respond to this immediately and adequately so that the child's resiliency is going to be able to shine.
Well, and you said in the Morning Edition series that addiction has infiltrated the whole child welfare system, Moira. So I'll ask you about that in a minute. But Rebecca, I want to bring you in as well. What are the ways, large or small, that you see kids being affected by the opioid epidemic?
Right. They are what we're seeing are large and small problems. I mean, we know that this crisis is really disrupting children's stability, upending their lives. And I think it's important to point out, too, that, you know, we're experiencing a number of crises in New Hampshire that are impacting children. We have the opioid crisis that we're hearing a lot about. You know, as Moira mentioned, there's a mental health crisis going on and a child welfare crisis going on. And I think it's really important that, you know, there's a lot of work being done in the state to address these crises, but, you know, there's more that can be done to really align and integrate all that work and make sure that we're moving towards more of an integrated system of care for children. You know, it's really our obligation to provide children impacted by these crises with a really coordinated and, as Maura said, a trauma-informed support system that really allows us to prevent, recognize, and respond to behavioral health problems early and consistently throughout a child's development.
You know, I thought it was so interesting that you're talking about, you know, coordinated approach. One of the things that surprised me, what Mary McIntyre told us, is that despite all these people working on this, Rebecca, there are still gaps in the system. So I just wonder what you think about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that any sort of policy initiative really can't consider the opioid addiction crisis in isolation. It really has to be seen as an interconnected symptom within a larger context. In July, actually, the Department of Health and Human Services issued a report. It was an adequacy and enhancement assessment of the DCYF system, and it included really sweeping system reform recommendations to make all child-serving systems more preventive, more comprehensive, more accessible, more coordinated, and more integrated.
Why do you think it's so hard to close some of these gaps, again, given the attention and given all the people who are working on this?
Yeah, because I think, you know, because of the limited funds we do have available in New Hampshire, we often just address the crises, right? And so if a child is having a behavioral crisis, we want to deal with that immediately. If a family is experiencing a crisis related to an opioid addiction, we want to address that immediately.
So we want to, you know, first plug all the leaks before we look at the broad health or lack thereof of the dam. Let's go to our listeners, all of you, and then there's so much more to talk about. Our number again here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at the opioid crisis and its impact on New Hampshire's children. We're following up on the recent series by NHPR's Morning Edition team called Taking a Toll. If you want to look at the series or listen to it, you can go to our website, nhpr.org. You can also send us an email right now, exchange@nhpr.org, or call 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go to our listeners. Darlene's in Concord. Hi, Darlene. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning, Darlene. Go ahead.
My question is, with Rebecca was speaking about the system of care. My daughter's been hospitalized 5 times, and each time she comes out of the hospital, she only has 1 session once a week with a mental health therapist, and the only day program, called an intensive treatment program, is 1 hour from my house in Nashua. So my comment, I guess, and my question is, what can we do to boost our services post-hospitalization so that the child doesn't keep having to go into the hospital and then perhaps in the future have an addiction problem as they struggle to get services for their mental health issue?
And how old is your daughter, Darlene, if I could ask?
She's 13.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah, so once a week doesn't sound adequate, and once a week and far away. Peter, what do you think? Does Darlene's story sound typical?
Yeah, Darlene, I'm really sorry that you're having such a difficult time. I think she raises a really interesting point, which is, has our system got to this point over the last year, or has there been a systematic neglect of a system over the past decade or 2 decades that's led us to a problem in New Hampshire, and I would say beyond New Hampshire as well, in the rest of the country? Those programs are expensive programs to run. In the mental health arena, about 86% of our funding comes from Medicaid. There have not been Medicaid adjustments in rates in a decade.
And that sounds really technical, but what that means is not a lot of people go into this field because it just doesn't pay very well.
Right, and there are workforce issues. And I think Becky said before, you can't have a conversation about substance use disorder without having a conversation about the entire system as it is at the moment.
Well, Darlene, we'll talk more after a short break. And again, very sorry to hear about your daughter. And we will pick up some of those threads that you raised, Darlene, and that Peter raised in just a moment. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
What's happening in the midterm elections before you vote in November is important. But what about what's going to happen in December or January? Hi, I'm Lauren Chulgin, politics and policy reporter for NHPR. When you give each month as a sustainer, you help NHPR and NPR cover the entire election. What happened before, what's going on now, and especially what's coming next. Be a part of what comes next. Become an NHPR sustainer today at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the opioid crisis and New Hampshire's children. We're following up on the series produced last week by NHPR's Morning Edition team called Taking a Toll. It's part of NHPR's broader Crossroad project, covering the many impacts of opioid addiction. Let's get your questions and your personal experiences in. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Peter Evers, CEO of Riverbend Community Mental Health, also Moira O'Neill, Director of the New Hampshire Office of the Child Advocate, and Rebecca Whitley, Policy Director for the New Hampshire Children's Behavioral Health Collaborative. And Rebecca, just before the break, we heard from Darlene, whose daughter is 13 years old. It's heartbreaking. She's been hospitalized 5 times, I think she said, and really having a hard time just finding a way out of addiction.
Right. And I think what Darlene is referencing, too, is that sort of cycle where when children are having a behavioral health crisis.
Mental health. That's right. That's what
right.
Darlene
said. Well, you know, it could be both. And oftentimes they are, you know, there's children that are experiencing co-occurring disorders as well. But I think what she's really identifying and experiencing is that real urgency to strengthen community-based services to meet the needs of these children that are experiencing crises. I think when a kiddo is in crises, caregivers and families really have limited options at this point. You can, you know, bring your child to the emergency room and sort of wait there until there's perhaps an inpatient bed, or, you know, in a time of real crisis, families feel like they can only turn to law enforcement and sort of call the police. But there are other ways to sort of even to avoid that, essentially, to avoid the need for inpatient. We're talking a lot in the children's behavioral health system about the need for mobile crisis response and stabilization services. These are actually more cost-effective alternatives than sending children to inpatient settings like New Hampshire Hospital. These are a way for teams to go to the family to support them in crisis, to de-escalate the crisis, and then connect them with services to stabilize the crises. So that's a real gap in the system right now.
So emergency rooms, law enforcement, that's where a lot of families end up turning. Why aren't there more mobile crisis units or just more services in general for children? Is this just not an area where people are interested in working? Is this not an area where they just isn't enough on the ground to take care of kids, or what?
Yeah, it's very complex. I mean, I think, you know, as other guests have mentioned, there's been a degradation of the system for many, many years. And so we do have a true lack of funding. And then I think it's sort of going back to what we were talking about before, is thinking through, you know, that coordination at a system level. There's sort of a traditional reliance on inpatient settings where we want our children to be safe, and sort of, you know, thinking about other alternatives that are keeping kids in the community can often be scary. I think even for families, you know, I just want my kid to be safe. I, you know, when they're in crisis, I want them to be safe. And so it's really a philosophical shift as well.
Well, Darlene, thank you for calling, and really the best of luck with your daughter from all of us here. Before I go back to more listeners, and lots of people want to jump into our conversation, so that's great. I did want to ask all of you, and maybe you first, Moira. New Hampshire has long had a higher than average rate of substance abuse. I'm thinking of alcohol, for example, has been a problem here for a long time, high rates of binge drinking and so forth. So what's the difference now, Moira, in terms of this opioid crisis and its impact on kids?
Well, you're right, Laura. There has always been, you know, a problem with substance use here in New Hampshire, and this has really exacerbated it. The availability of opiates and the way that opiates affect people's bodies and how they behave and what they do. And it also sometimes brings in a certain level of criminality to the situation, too, because opiates are already illegal. So what people do through their addictions is exposing children to all of that all of the time. So it's just sort of exacerbated overall. I'll mention that when children are removed from their families because they're not being cared for, which isn't easy to do, so things have to be really bad when that happens. They're appointed a court-appointed special advocate to help the child sort of guide them through and make sure their rights are covered. So CASA is a court-appointed special advocate. So they are covering in the last year about 867 families. That's any number of kids within those families. There were another about 130 families that they just didn't have enough volunteers for. But of those 867 families, 75% of them have known substance use problems. And there were a good number that we just don't know whether they did or not. So that's really a large number. And of that 75%, 78% had opiates involved in the situation.
Wow.
So you can see that it's sort of overtaking. I don't know, is it cheaper, more accessible, or is it just more problematic than alcohol? But it certainly has become a serious problem for families, and that complicates things. So the role of the Office of the Child Advocate is to oversee the Division of Children, Youth, and Families, and that's the sort of agency that's on the line for helping kids who are in these scenarios. So we've been working hard to figure out how is DCYF responding to this. We were lucky to accompany them and several legislators to New Jersey this past summer to look at their system of care and how they're responding to these kinds of issues, how they're bringing together, sort of integrating services.
Is it making a difference in New Jersey?
I think it's making a huge difference in New Jersey. Within an hour, anywhere in the state of New Jersey, if a family defines itself in crisis with their child, someone will be at the house.
Wow.
So that's the mobile response crisis capacity that we're looking for here. They've dropped the number of kids who are in care. They've dropped the number of kids who are out of state in institutions. It's changed. They actually closed a mental health hospital there because they've been able to meet the needs in the community for kids who are in crisis. So that's across the board. That's mental health, behavioral health.
And that's the goal, to not put a child in, you know, a state hospital or some sort of institution waiting for days and days and days in the emergency room, as happens here in New Hampshire. But I'm wondering, you know, I'm listening to Moira talk, Peter, and we're all kind of going, wow, that's amazing, and that they even closed a whole hospital because they had such good community services. Here in New Hampshire, Peter, there are help wanted signs everywhere. Including, I'm guessing, in the behavioral health field. So how could we even reach a point that New Jersey has reached where someone shouts for help, within an hour, help is there?
Yeah, well, I think it takes a number of things. And Becky said before that we can't attack these issues in silos. We have to begin to think about system redesign. And really, that's what happened, I think, in New Jersey, and it's happened in other places. Sometimes it happens because there's a federal lawsuit. Other times, legislatures are more thoughtful about that because you really don't want a clinical decision to be driven by a federal lawsuit. But unfortunately, that's what's happening in this state. I think as we begin to think about systems, then we begin to solve the problem. For instance, the idea of a hub-and-spoke system of care, I think, is one that has been adopted all over the country. That is, with one portal for a family to call. And I just want to go to crisis being in the eye of the beholder. It is not us as clinicians who determine what somebody's crisis is. It is somebody reaching out for help. And oftentimes, the psychic pain of going through behavioral health crisis, mental health crisis, are so awful that people don't want to reach out. And when they do reach out and ask for help and they get a brickbat and they say, well, really, that's not a crisis. How does that feel to a family who's saying, I want help? So this whole redesign of our attitude, mentality about being a receiving organization rather than being a gatekeeper. And we do that because our resources are short. But as we begin to talk about what the system looks like to the individual searching for those services, I think we get a better idea of bringing people in. But workforce is a huge issue, Laura. We have the average age of psychiatrists in this country is 58 years old. We are freshly minting 1,100 new psychiatrists a year in this country.
For the whole country?
For the whole
country.
That
doesn't sound like very much.
It is not. And most of those folks tend to want to be in the big cities like Boston, New York, Los Angeles, etc. So we do have a problem with that. It's not just psychiatrists, though. It's it's social workers, it's psychologists, it's advanced practice nurses. There's a shortage and there's a brain drain, I think, in the state, because Medicaid rates, for instance, are higher, almost double in some states, which are neighboring us. So we really need to address those issues all at the same time.
Well, and you mentioned hub and spoke, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, because that's part of the plan that the governor and the DHHS commissioner have for dispersing this big chunk of federal money that's coming in. So we'll definitely talk about that. But let's go back to our listeners, all of you. And up next is Sue calling in from the Seacoast. Hi, Sue. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. So some of my questions were kind of answered and talked about as I was listening. But I just want to say that, you know, so we've adopted two, they're currently 12-year-old boys, through the foster care system. And we found that when we're in the system, we have lots of support and people are helping. But once we get out of the system, we do have a post-adopt group that is great. But the mental health piece is just really, really difficult, because a lot of people think that once the kids are adopted, they're fine. And they're not. I mean, my boys have reactive attachment disorder because of one being born addicted and the other one having, you know, opioids in his life since he was born. And so the attachment isn't there. And so now we're running into, they're going through puberty. I have two 12-year-old boys. They're in middle school, and that in itself is a lot. But now we're finding the gaps in the system, wait lists, not being able to get care.
Whereas when they were fostered, when you were foster parenting them, Sue, it was easier to get access to all that?
It was, because we had a huge group behind us,
sure,
including, you know, all the way up to the state. And so we found that it was a little bit easier.
How old were the boys when you adopted them?
One was 8 and the other one was 10.
Okay, yeah. And what sorts of issues did you notice given their direct experience with opioid addiction in their biological homes?
Yeah, well, they both have significant learning disabilities because, as they talked about earlier, the brain development is huge. And without that part being nurtured, it's really difficult for them to be able to concentrate on schoolwork. We have some short-term memory loss issues. We have some significant behavior that comes from the reactive attachment disorder that the kids have. And, you know, I heard earlier, or maybe on a prior program, someone say that, you know, after, you know, the years of love and all that kind of stuff, then they get better and they do well. And some do, but some don't. And I think we need to make sure that people know in families, like, we are all in 100%. We're doing everything we can for our children, but sometimes they don't always get better. And
wow.
So the support that we need with the mental health stuff and in the school system is huge with that. We have had to call the police and have the police here at our home, and other people being in safe places within the home. And it's hard because who wants to call the police on their 10-year-old? But it comes to a safety issue. And so the crisis, I'm really happy to hear, because that was one of my big questions. What do we do when we're in crisis, because we have to call for an appointment and we can get in next week, when we're in crisis now? And my child is not a criminal. He's just sick.
Yeah,
you
wow.
know? And so,
so
I want to treat him that way, but I also need to keep my other children safe.
I am so glad that you called, and I am so sorry to hear about your struggles. And Rebecca, I'm going to turn to you first, but anybody jump in. I mean, she's kind of talking about what you were talking about, a lack of services, a lack of immediate help in a crisis. She also touched on what Moira talked about earlier, the impact of trauma on that developing childhood brain. But go ahead, Rebecca, please.
Yeah. And Sue, thanks for calling and sharing your story. And, you know, I think it sounds like your children came to your family with, you know, a lifetime of experiences that no children should ever have experienced. I mean, as we talked about before, you know, chronic negative experiences during early childhood can really produce toxic stress in a child, and that can lead to lifelong problems in learning, behavior, and health. But I think, Sue, I do want to provide hope to you and to this and to our listeners that investments in this area and providing trauma-informed supports and trauma-responsive systems can really mitigate the impact of trauma on brain development. Research has really shown that with appropriate supports and early intervention, that people really can overcome traumatic experiences.
But that childhood brain, excuse me for interrupting, is really plastic,
yes,
and can be reshaped. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think, Laura, that raises the issue of prevention, too, you know, particularly in adolescence. You know, it's a very sensitive time for brain development, and we know substance abuse can really sort of interrupt that that time and really have long-term physical and mental health implications. And I think that, you know, to the extent we are, again, going back to these system issues and developing a framework of prevention and trauma-informed care that really takes a multi-generational approach to the whole epidemic. And just as Sue says, are supporting families to get, you know, early intervention and early access to services once we've identified these children.
Well, and Sue, I'm so glad you called. And a slightly different question for you, Moira, just stemming from Sue's very moving call. So we heard from her about how disruptive drug addiction was for her children. We've heard her talk firsthand about the impacts of early childhood trauma on the brain. Given all this, Moira, at what point is it appropriate to terminate parental rights?
Well, so, you know, I want to thank Sue for calling in, too. It's really important that we share these stories. This is how we educate each other. And this is the conversations like this is where we're going to start to make a change. So I appreciate the opportunity, and I appreciate Sue stepping up. And so terminating parental rights, this is what you're talking about, is when a child is, his parents are in the throes of an addiction, and DCYF is involved, the child is in care. What happens is when you when you're taken into care, the federal law requires that within 12 months you're back with your family or you're with another family. And what we're seeing in the courts, the rate of termination of parental rights has risen, and last year it was up to 67% higher. So it's actually happening more, and the judges think that this has something to do with the opiate crisis. So more and more kids are being separated permanently from their parents. Part of the problem is that parents aren't able to access treatment in time, or their devastation of opioids on them is probably just making it too difficult for them to recover in a way that they can resume their parenting. So that becomes very complicated. But you really do need to focus on that child developing in those early years, needing to be able to move on, attach to a family, have some permanency, have what we call an emotional safe space. But to Sue's point, I just want to point out that we know so much about the brain now with all the science that we have. We know that brains don't finish developing until early 20s. So that's that frontal lobe where you're making decisions, you're having insight, you're understanding your impact on others, you're managing your behaviors. So we do need to focus on these older kids. And what Sue is experiencing, they came into a system, the system responded, they got great foster parents and adoptive parents who are looking after their needs, but it doesn't end. And this is what was described earlier, where people get help. Now you're seeing caseworkers who almost don't want to get help for kids because they know after they've been in residential placement or in the hospital, when they get home, they'll have nothing available to them. So it's all back to building a system of care. We have several initiatives right now. We have the hub and spoke. We have the system of care. We have other things. We have to make sure it's all integrated, that there's services for whatever families think they need.
Beyond, you know, she got lots of help when her kids were foster children, but once they were sort of adopted and considered a quote-unquote regular family, some of that dropped off. So
right.
I'm really glad that you called. And thank you so much, Sue. Good luck to you. And we will talk a little bit more about this hub and spoke because it keeps coming up. Also, the incoming federal money for helping with opioid addiction here in New Hampshire. We'll find out where our guests think that would be best spent. And we'll take a lot more of your calls and emails. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our number 1-800-892-6477.
Hey there, it's Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A on NHPR. And as a fan of the show, I wanted to let you know that we are coming to New Hampshire, and you can be part of the conversation. Join me for an evening of fantastic discussion about issues that matter to you and to the Granite State. Join us on Thursday, October 18th at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord. You can get your tickets right now at ccanh.com. See you then.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, what the Governor's Task Force on School Safety recommended and responses to it. Join us for that Tuesday on The Exchange. This hour, we're looking at the impact of New Hampshire's opioid crisis on children. And let's hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. What effects have you seen on kids that you know from this opioid epidemic? And what do you think is the best way to help these children? One more time, our number, 1-800-892-6477. And of all of you, we keep touching on this, so let's hit it head on. And Peter, to you first. The good news is, many people in this field feel, that there is a significant chunk of federal change coming in, $45 million over 2 years. How do you think that money would best be spent, Peter?
Well, I think it should be spent in a way that can be sustained after 2 years. I think that's something that we worry about a lot, that we'll build a big system and then there won't be any money for afterwards. But I would say that I think that the state are doing a good job on identifying key entry points to the system for people who need these services. I would say that this is a statewide opioid response, so the money is targeted to opioids. I think we've all made the point that it's more than opioids. You know, there is a meth issue at the moment. There is, of course, a longstanding alcohol issue. But here is the opportunity for us to build a system that has really good transitions of care for people. I think we all know that people fall through the cracks in the system when the transitions of care are not very good, when there aren't warm handoffs and closed-loop referrals that get people to where they need to be. So building that infrastructure through medication-assisted treatment, which is there is at the moment a response out from the state to say, how can we get people treated on an outpatient basis with buprenorphine, which is the standard of care at the moment? And also, how can we build more mobile responses so that we meet people in their community? It's interesting. We run a mobile crisis team here. If we see people in the community, they are 25% likely to go to a higher level of care. If we see people in the ED, in the emergency department, they're 75% of the time they're going to a higher level of care.
Meaning New Hampshire Hospital or what, Peter?
New Hampshire Hospital, they may actually end up in custody, because of dysregulation in the emergency room, which is, by the way, understandable if somebody spends 30 days in an emergency department, which is not that unusual.
30 days?
Yes. And that really goes to the crisis that we have, that we don't have the ability to move people out of higher levels of care back into the community. And therefore, that creates a barrier at the front door as well. So I think getting this money out to providers, investing in prevention, investing in peer support, those people with lived experiences. A lot of studies are showing now that that the work that people do with lived experiences with folks is as important as clinical interventions. And as clinicians, we need to accept that and buy into that and make sure we have peer support workers in ED so that they can have those crucial conversations with somebody as they are status post-overdose and that kind of thing. So I'm really, really excited about the fact that there's all this money coming in. I'm really excited that it's getting to people as quickly as possible. I'm a little worried about the cliff that we might fall off
after 2 years,
in 24 months.
What happens? Yeah. What do you think, Moira, in terms of what you've heard about how this money is going to be spent?
Well, I just want to point out that you know, it's really wonderful that we've got this great chunk of money coming from the federal government. But, you know, any money that comes from the federal government generally is targeted in certain ways. And what we've seen so far is that a lot of that money isn't necessarily targeted towards children. So it is really important that we attack the problem of opiates, the opiates addictions and their misuse. But we also at the same time have to be building a system around children as well, because children are going to end up being also in need of other things if we don't take care of them now. So it's just really important that any initiative that we have that hub and spoke around the federal opiate money. The system of care that that the Division of Children, Youth, and Families is going to be rolling out. There's a 10-year mental health plan coming along. All of those things have to be connected, and there has to be a constant awareness of children's needs throughout that process.
Are you feeling, Moira, that so far what you've seen from the planned spending for this federal money isn't focused enough on children? Because maybe these children aren't addicted themselves, but they have a lot of problems in the home because parents are addicted.
Right. So it really is, from my understanding, it's a focus on prevention and treatment. And that generally is, you know, looking at the adults. The children will absolutely benefit from that because their parents will hopefully get the treatment that they need. But in the meantime, what are the specific needs that children have? And we have an overburdened child welfare system with foster parents who aren't able to, you know, there aren't enough of them to take care of these kids in the meantime. So we really do need to be looking at other programs that might immediately help are building more programs of living in where mothers can be getting treatment and have their babies with them. We have very small resources for that sort of thing. Making sure that we're constantly assessing anytime anyone walks into a room where someone's dealing with a substance use disorder, there's a question about how are the children? Are the children here? Are they impacted? What are we going to do for them in the meantime?
So when someone with an addiction or who just recovers from an overdose and is ready for help, you're saying one of the first questions we should ask is, do you have children?
Right.
You know, there has been this sort of criticism that some of this concern that some of this opioid money isn't focused enough on the kids who, as we're hearing this hour, are struggling. We did get a note from DHHS that said, while services will be made available to anyone seeking assistance, special populations outlined will be made a priority for some of the program designs in this proposal. These special populations include children and young adults, pregnant women, older adults caring for a minor child due to Division for Children, Youth, and Families involvement. So there seems to be some recognition, Moira, that kids need help.
Right. And there, and I think that there are some efforts around substance use treatment for children. But what I'm talking about is children who are not personally taking substances. They're people who are living with and around those who are dealing with substance use disorders. And so that's another set of needs. It's another set of assessment that we have to make sure that we have to be really careful that everybody is okay, that they're in a safe, stable home, that they're emotionally safe, that they have people who are not harming them in any way, whether it's physically or emotionally, and that they're able to grow and develop. So that's another whole sort of shift in terms of how we have to respond to this crisis.
Rebecca, what do you think about this federal money coming in and some of the points that Peter and Moira raise?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree that, you know, the $45 million coming in from the federal government is a lot of money, and that's a good thing. And to the extent that we're connecting parents to treatment, that can only help, you know, the welfare of our children. But I do share the concern that, you know, what we want to avoid is creating parallel systems of care. We don't want to have a system that operates in silos, because that all that does is leave children and families without access to what they need, when they need, and where they need it. I mean, the whole idea of developing a system of care is developing a coherent response to whatever issue a child may be encountering. And so absolutely, you know, when we are dealing with a situation with an influx of money, we need to look at the impacts on children and how we can build on the existing work to build out a system of care for children and how we can, you know, connect all the dots there.
Describe the silos that you see now. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in the children's behavioral health system in particular, we know that children are getting services in well-meaning systems. You know, children with behavioral health issues are getting services in schools. They are in the juvenile justice system, so they could be getting access to services there. Obviously, in the child welfare system, they're getting services. Clearly, in the mental health system, they're getting services. And so the idea of moving away from these silos and more towards an integrated system of care is to break down those silos and make sure that we are all talking to each other. And, you know, with the ultimate benefit of helping families. So currently, if a family is experiencing whatever crisis they're experiencing with their child, they could go through multiple doors, all of which could be the wrong doors. And so the idea with integration is that there could be one single point of entry into the system, right? Whatever the crisis the family and children are experiencing, there's one single point of entry where they can access the supports and services that they need.
So we don't have that now.
We don't have that.
Families sort of flounder. And we heard earlier from Sue, who's, you know, tried law enforcement. And we heard earlier from Darlene, who had tried the emergency room. So that's an example of what you're talking about.
Right. And the hope with the hub and spoke model that is being developed from this money coming from the federal government, that's the idea of it, that there will be one sort of number to call and the services will fan out from there. But it remains to be seen how that will be integrated for children.
Wow. Okay. So let's go back to our listeners. And Rosie's in Mount Vernon. Hi, Rosie. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome. Rosie, you with us? All right, Rosie, hope you call back. Let's go to Jacqueline in Thornton. Hi, Jacqueline. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for this show.
It's, sure.
Very informative. I have recently moved to New Hampshire and am a retired nurse and would like to know how I can help. I live in Thornton and have experience working with children who've been abused and neglected, both on the inpatient and outpatient services. And
Jacqueline, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead. So just wondering, as a retired nurse who just moved to the state, how you can maybe help with this issue. And what do you think, Peter?
First of all, Jacqueline, welcome to New Hampshire.
And Thornton is a beautiful place.
And Thornton's absolutely lovely. And if you could persuade any other nurses to come, that'd be great too. I think there's lots of opportunities. If there are a community mental health center, of course, that is in your area and local hospitals. I think the sharp end of it is, as we said before, is the emergency department. And, you know, emergency departments need a lot of education on how to manage folks who are presenting in these sort of physical crises. So there are lots of different opportunities. There's lots of different agencies that provide peer support as well. And I would be happy to continue a conversation with you about what services are up there and who to speak to.
Go ahead, Moira, yeah.
And I'd also add, I mean, it's great to have your clinical experience if you want to continue in a clinical role, but also your experience would be really helpful as an advocate for children. The New Hampshire CASA, the court-appointed special advocates, are really hurting for more volunteers, and in that role you could advocate for a child who's in the child welfare system who needs to have services. You know, you could make sure that they're getting the services that they need. You could be informing the courts and informing the child welfare system itself what those needs are that a child needs and make sure that they get them.
Yeah, and I want to let you, Jacqueline, know, and everybody listening, that we've got lots of links and further information on our website. So it's nhpr.org/exchange. You can listen to the Morning Edition series as well called Taking a Toll. Put a link up on our website there, but also lots of information for people like you, Jacqueline. So thank you for calling in. Our number again is 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, we've been talking mostly about kids who are in families, where there's addiction, all the struggles that they have, the impact on the brain. But Peter, I wanted to ask you, how likely is it that a child who grows up in a family with substance abuse will end up with addiction problems themselves?
Well, I think it depends, of course, would be my answer. It is highly likely that there will be issues. You know, when we look at the adverse childhood events manifest, you know, we find out that people are dying younger if they have adverse trauma. We're looking at they're getting their primary care in the emergency department, that they're smoking more cigarettes, that they're using more drugs, that they have less access to primary care, medical care. And the allostatic load, as they call it, which is the physical toll that this constant stress plays upon them, are all vulnerabilities to addiction. On the other hand, we mentioned resilience before, and resilience is so important. And it is that period, that time when you meet a child and you don't know what benefit your interaction is going to have with that child. It might be the beginning of a pathway out of this issue that they're in. It might be a pathway to education, to reading, that kind of stuff. So there's always resilience in children, this sort of elasticity of the brain, which I think is the hope that we should take away from today.
Well, and I wonder, Rebecca, given what teenagers are seeing with adults and addiction, you know, those just a little bit older than them, is this generation of teenagers saying, you know, no way? Or are they, you know, turning to other substances? Are they becoming addicted themselves? I wonder, you know, again, if you're 13, 14, 15 years old and you see the toll that this has taken on those above you, are you saying, not touching it?
Yeah, I think it really is hard to generalize for all teenagers, you know, sort of what they're experiencing, what their experience is. You know, back to Peter's point, I think, you know, there is evidence there that those children that are experiencing those adverse childhood experiences in their home in early childhood, that they are more likely to experience substance use disorders as adults. We know that's
there. Because you self-medicate.
Well, yeah, and we know that that changes the brain and that they, you know, that they are seeing those implications long term. But again, I think it's important to remember that we can change that, and that, you know, that children, because children need those stable connections to develop those brain connections and develop that capacity for emotional bonding and for resilience, there are trauma-specific interventions specifically designed to address the consequences of trauma and to facilitate healing and mitigate the potential long-term impacts. I mean, there are specific interventions for young children. Child-parent psychotherapy is provided with whoever is the primary caregiver. That could be the parent, that could be the grandparent, that could be the foster parent. And it can be done in a way that builds that resiliency for when there are adolescents and older. And I, you know, for older children, there's trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy for youth 6 to 18. And there are providers in the state doing both those services. So again, the importance of building up those trauma-informed interventions is so critical.
And creating that one-stop shopping, so to speak, that opens up the door so people don't knock on doors that are not appropriate. Maura, I'd love to close out with you. What is it going to take for New Hampshire to turn the tide on this? It's heartbreaking to hear the stories about how the opioid epidemic has affected young people.
It is. But first, I want to just really simplify it. I think Jacqueline asked a great question, how can I help? Throughout all the research we've done, the one thing that makes the biggest difference in a child's life is a single, consistent, caring adult. So no matter who you are, how much you interact with a child, be positive, be supportive, care about that child, be consistent. Sometimes it's a janitor, sometimes it's somebody at the post office, sometimes it's a teacher, sometimes it's a parent or another family member. But as long as kids know that they are cared about, they will be resilient.
Okay, we'll close it out on a hopeful note. I really appreciate all of you coming in. There's a lot more we could have talked about. Moira, it was really good to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Moira O'Neill, Director of the New Hampshire Office of the Child Advocate. Rebecca, thank you also for your time.
Thanks so much, Laura.
Rebecca Whitney, she's Policy Director for the New Hampshire Children's Behavioral Health Collaborative. And Peter Evers, always good to have you. Thank you so much. That's Peter Evers, CEO of Riverbend Community Mental Health. Again, check out our website for more information. It's nhpr.org/exchange. And this is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.